I'd like to call this meeting of the House State Affairs Committee to order. The time is 3:19 on Tuesday, March 17. Happy St. Patrick's Day. We are here in room 120, and please remember to silence cell phones. Representatives present today are Representative St. Clair, Representative McCabe, Representative Vance, Representative Holland, Representative Himshute, Vice Chair Story, and myself, Chair Carrick. Let the record reflect we have a quorum to conduct business. Our record secretary today is Andy Magnuson, and our moderator from the Juneau LAO is Renzo Moises. Our committee aide for today's hearing is my staff, Stuart Relay. On today's agenda, we have three items. First is bringing back before the committee House Bill 189 on PFD convictions from Representative Mears. And after that, we looks like have both House Bill 214 from Representative Galvin and House Bill 295 from Representative McCabe. So before we get started, too, I just wanted to extend the amendment deadline. Reset the amendment deadline for House Bill 152, the also known as the Education Head Tax Bill. And the new deadline is tomorrow, March 18th at 5 p.m. The intention is to take up this bill on Thursday. Okay. We have already received several amendments, so if you have any final amendments you're hoping to get submitted, please do your best to get them in before we hear the bill again on Thursday by the deadline. The first item on today's agenda is House Bill 189 on PFD convictions overturned from Representative Mears. This is our second hearing on the bill. Today, the plan is to adopt a committee substitute and continue discussion on the bill. Very brief, please. House State Affairs is back on the record. I'd also just like to note on House Bill 189 for members that we're joined by PFD Division Director Genevieve Washtusik and Nancy Mead from the Alaska Court System. And before we get into discussion on HB 189, we do have a committee substitute before us. And so I turn to Vice Chair Story for a motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that the House State Affairs Committee adopt CS for House Bill 189, also known as 34-LS0895/N, as our working document.
Thank you, Vice Chair Story. I'm going to object to ask our committee aide to walk through the summary of changes. Mr. Relay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Stuart Relay, staff for Representative Carrick. For committee members' information, the only changes are in Section 1 of the bill. The first change is in subsection I.1, and that is on page 1, line 11 through 13, specifying under which circumstances a conviction was dismissed for someone to be eligible for their PFD. The dismissal may not be part of a plea agreement under Rule 11 of the Alaska Rules of Criminal Procedure. The other change in Section 1 of the bill is under subsection J. It specifies that back payment of a dividend is not prohibited because of a deposit of an equivalent amount of money into the restorative justice account. Those, Madam Chair, are the changes.
Okay. Thank you. And I might ask the bill sponsor, Representative Mears, and her staff to also come to the table and offer any additional comments as desired on the committee substitute.
Thank you, Representative Donna Mears, House District 21, South Muldoon.
Talia Ames, staff to Representative Mears. We don't have any comments on the changes. I think Stuart broke it down pretty well. If you need explanation on the Rule 11, the plea deal part, Nancy Mead can talk about that.
Thank you. Do we have any additional questions or discussions on the committee substitute? Representative Himshute?
Thank you. I wouldn't mind asking Nancy Mead a question.
Yes, for sure. Ms. Mead, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Hi. Thank you. Through the chair, my question is, so this means if the person who was wrongfully, no, the person was correctly convicted, but the charges are dismissed later, is different from someone who is wrongfully convicted. Is that what this is clarifying?
For the record, Nancy Mead, general counsel to the Alaska court system. I might phrase it a little bit differently. I think the goal of the bill is to identify those who were convicted but never should have been convicted, generally because of innocence. And that's what they would like, the intent of the bill is to address those people and provide their PFDs because they were wrongfully withheld in that scenario. The change, the addition of those extra words on page 1, line 12 and 13 is to ensure that if the case was later dismissed, and that, by the way, is dismissal by the prosecutor who has the discretion when a case goes back to the trial court to retry it or not, if they choose to dismiss, the person would be considered wrongfully convicted because if your case is dismissed, you're no longer convicted. But sometimes the prosecutor enters a plea agreement when people have multiple open cases at the trial level. So you might have an assault case from an October and a drug case from December. And sometimes they'll get a plea agreement in, say, the drug case, and as part of the agreement, we'll dismiss that assault case. But that person is not really intended to be covered by this because that dismissal is not because of innocence. It is part of a deal. And so this wording is used in other contexts in law to address those circumstances. For example, we take down from court view people whose cases were dismissed because they're considered, you know, not guilty, but not if they were dismissed as part of a plea in another case, because that is not as strong an indicator of actual innocence in that circumstance.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. I understand Ms. Mead may have to leave fairly soon. Do we have any additional questions for her on either this committee substitute or the underlying bill? Okay. Just wanted to check. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Is there any additional discussion on the committee substitute? Representative St. Clair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is probably for the bill sponsor or her staff. Okay, sorry. I was looking at my notes because I wrote them down a little bit earlier. We've had this conversation, Representative Mears, you and I, in reference to the indeterminate fiscal note, and that still remains, correct?
Correct.
With the amended or the new CS, it is double dipping into the dividend, paying it twice, paying it to the restorative justice fund and paying it to the individual as back pay if their case was dismissed or they were acquitted.
Through the chair to Representative St. Clair, I wouldn't utilize the phrase double dipping. That I think implies that the individual is benefiting twice from that, which is not the case.
Follow up. Well, do you agree then we're taking two draws for basically the same person?
Through the chair to Representative St. Clair, that's closer, I think, to what's happening in this case.
Follow up. And we still don't know how many cases would fall into this category. Have fallen in the last whatever, if you have stats, or that we anticipate will fall into this category that the Permanent Fund Corporation is going to have to pay out.
Through the chair to Representative St. Clair, there have been 5 identified cases in the last couple of decades. Moving forward, we don't know. I think, given our past record, have a lot of justified faith in our justice system that it is not incarcerating innocent individuals. And some of that, I believe, is incumbent on us to make sure that that system remains viable and supported, so that that doesn't change.
Okay, thank you.
Any additional questions on the committee substitute at this time? Representative Vance?
Just rereading the language and especially the transition language. Does this cover only potential people moving forward, or does it also capture the Fairbanks Four and the people who originally highlighted this discrepancy?
Can I do that?
Sure.
Through the chair to Representative Vance, it does include the Fairbanks Four. It's anybody who is identified prior to the passing of this bill, should it pass, will have 1 year to apply for the back dividend. And in the future, if somebody should be identified again as wrongfully incarcerated, they would have 1 year after that happens, they're identified as wrongly incarcerated to apply. So it covers the past and hopefully not anymore in the future, but it would.
Follow up, am I seeing that in the transition language? Is that where that's identified?
I believe
through the chair. Yes.
Yeah, Representative Vance, I believe that is on page 3 in the transition language. It says in the last few lines there that if the dismissal or not guilty finding occurred before the effective date of this act, they shall apply and have not later than 1 year after the effective date of the act. So I believe it's covered there. Okay, thank you. I don't see any additional questions or discussions on the committee substitute, and so I'm going to remove my objection to the committee substitute. And seeing and hearing no additional objection, the committee substitute for House Bill 189, version N, is adopted as the working document. And let's see. Is there additional discussion at this time on House Bill 189? Representative St. Clair.
This is just, thank you, Madam Chair. This is just a discussion. It's nothing, not a direct question for the sponsor. I understand what this legislation is trying to do. However, I see that an individual that was wrongly incarcerated is going to sue the individuals that incarcerated them. Within that is going to be unlawful detention, loss of revenue, which could include the PFD. I know I would include it if it were me, in a lawsuit. So is this something that we really need to do, or is this pretty much once every 5 to 10 years is where I'm getting at this? And with it, I'm really hung up on the indeterminate fiscal note, and I understand that it could only happen once every 5 or 10 years, but an indeterminate fiscal note is an indeterminate fiscal note. We just don't know. And then until we can pare those numbers down a little bit, I'm not real comfortable with this. Thank you.
Representative Mears.
Thank you, through the chair. I know this is general discussion, but to the chair, to Representative St. Clair. So we don't know what cases may be in the contents of any legal action for suing, but it's my understanding that the Fairbanks Four signed an agreement that they would not sue the state. So we don't know what the terms of any future legal action might be. So by foreclosing this option is making assumptions about what may happen in a future case.
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Follow up. And I agree wholeheartedly. I was looking at a potential amendment or something saying that if they received these funds, they could not sue whoever was responsible for their erroneous incarceration, or switching it around the other way. But I know that goes a lot into litigation. So I understand what you're saying. I'm trying to find the right balance for me.
Thank you. And through the chair to Representative St. Clair. And there's all different levels of law enforcement and all different ways that folks could get there. So looking at the state as a party and that restoration of the permanent fund dividend check is, I think, a separate issue from what a lot of that could be.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative McCabe.
I'm good.
Oh. I thought you were trying to get my attention.
No, I'm just smiling because there's like 9 million people online to testify, I think.
Oh, you know what?
Not on this, but on the next bill.
You're right, Rep. McCabe. There are quite a few people waiting to testify. I don't see any additional discussion on House Bill 189. Is there any other questions for the bill sponsor? Seeing none, we are setting House Bill 189 aside. My intention is, as time may allow, in a upcoming future hearing, possibly Thursday, more likely at some point next week, that we will take House Bill 189 back up. Pursuant to that, I am setting an amendment deadline for this bill for tomorrow at 5 p.m. If folks do have a substantive number of amendments, please reach out to me right away so that we can plan accordingly in our schedule. So we do have several overlapping amendment deadlines today. But otherwise, we are setting House Bill 189 aside. Thank you, Representative Mears.
Thank you, House Stanford.
Brief at ease. House State Affairs is back on the record, and the next item on our agenda today is House Bill 295 relating to PFD eligibility for pilots from Representative McCabe. This is our third hearing on this bill. Today we are going to have continued discussion on the bill, take public testimony, and set an amendment deadline. I'd also like to note for committee members that today we're joined by PFD Division Director Genevieve Washtusik, who is still here with us, and I think potentially, let's go ahead and jump the gun here and go straight to public testimony. We do have a number of folks online today. So at this time, I will open public testimony on House Bill 295. I'm just going to note for our testifiers today, we will have a strict 2-minute time limit for testimony. And please remember to state your name and any affiliation for the record as you begin your testimony. And I do apologize in advance if I have to cut anybody off today. We will go ahead and start with Jay Farmwald in Anchorage.
Good afternoon, Jay Farmwald, Anchorage. I'm a 45-year resident. I'm a vet. I've got a son that's active duty Navy, a pilot. I'm here to support HB 295 that requests that a provision be added to waive or suspend the 5-year PFD rule for deployed military. The 5-year rule requires logging 30 days every running 5-year period after you've been gone for 5 years, like a student or a military. If you fail that rule once, your residency is severed. The rule cannot be appealed or waived by anyone at the state. Staff have advised me that it's difficult, if not impossible, to reestablish your residency while you're still on active duty if you fail the rule. So deployed is not the same as being assigned overseas with your family. Deployed means mission-specific assignment to high-risk areas, Persian Gulf, Syria, Iraq are examples. Kuwait, unfortunately, we all know, is a recent example. I've got a few examples of what the issue is. My examples are Navy context. So we're talking about submariners, SEALs, aircraft carrier personnel. What most people don't understand is that it's not just the deployment and the extensions. It's all the pre-deployment training and term of art workups that are required. The workups themselves are often at sea, like for a carrier, and that can be as long as 6 to 18 months on top of the deployment itself and any extensions. So it's real possible to not be able to take any leave or for up to a year and a half or even 2 years. My son, I'm going to give a couple of examples that are relevant, but it's not just about him. It's about all deployed military personnel. My son was born and raised in Alaska. He left for the Naval Academy in 16, graduated in 2020, spent 4 years in pilot training. There were a couple of years during that syllabus training where he couldn't get away for more than a couple of days. He's been deployed twice in the last 12 months. He's deployed now. They've told him that his third deployment will be later this year. Just getting very difficult to meet the five-year rule for career military that are in this period where they're deployed and in intensive training, getting ready to deploy. In closing, I would just say that the numbers are actually low. My estimates are maybe this waiver would impact 50 or so residents a year.
Mr. Farnwald,
so it's not a budget issue.
If you could just,
yes, ma'am?
If you could just wrap up your comments.
Yeah, 10 more seconds, please. So it's not a budget issue. It's a policy issue. I think providing an exception to the five-year rule for deployed military is simply the right thing to do. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We'll now go to Dan Leary, also in Anchorage.
Hello, my name is Dan Leary. I live in Anchorage, Alaska. I am a pilot for Horizon Airlines, the subsidiary of Alaska Airlines, or the regional ones. I fly or work 14 to 18 days a month. Some of those days are in Alaska. Some of those days are out of Alaska. I do not have control about where the vessel or plane is going. That is made by the company. As a result, we are very similar to Merchant Marines in that case, which is why the Bill 295 that would extend the exemption that Merchant Marines have to pilots and flight crew makes sense. When we are away, we are often only away for short periods of time in the actual destination. Often I'm only in the city for the layover for 4 hours between flights or 20 to 12 hours overnight. The burden of proof of residency when we're here, when we're and having to travel so much is kind of difficult to prove to the PSD department. The real concern I have is utilizing the proof of residency that the PSD requires for future legislation, such as the upcoming hunting and fishing requirements. Using the PSD requirement for residency might also be extended to future legislation that could expel many pilots and flight crew in Alaska from utilizing benefits that we should otherwise be entitled to. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Leary, for testifying. And we'll go next to Lucas Hickel in Wasilla.
Hi, how's it going?
Welcome. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for letting me speak today. And thank you, Mr. McCabe, for putting this bill forward. My name is Lucas Hickel. I was born in Palmer. I currently live in Wasilla. I've lived in Alaska my entire life. I went to flight school in Fairbanks, Palmer, and Anchorage, and I graduated from college in 2018 from UAA. I was hired as an airline pilot in 2021. And every single year since then, my PFD has been a nightmare. Trying to document every single time I leave the state for work and come home, trying to submit tax returns and explain out-of-state income tax. Dealing with the PFD division is never an easy thing to do. It takes forever to get responses. And when I talk to different people about my situation, I get different answers due to the complexities with the nature of my job. Every year I'm at risk of losing my PFD and now seeing my hunting and fishing residency. My freezer is full of moose and fish. It's a way of life for me and my family. We as flight crew have a very unique job that takes us all over the world. At the end of the day, though, my home is not the multitude of hotels that I stayed at around North America. It is in Wasilla, Alaska. This is where my wife and children are, my only house, my vehicles, all of my belongings. This is where I come from and go to after every work hitch is over. This is a great career and is essential to our modern society. Part of the job is being away from home, though. However, I'm always still going to be an Alaska resident. Please pass this bill to make the lives of thousands of crew members living here better. And I would also like to add flight attendants be included in this bill. They make the same sacrifices as us to be away from home, and they should not be rejected PFDs or residency as well. I'd like to thank everybody for their time.
Thank you, Mr. Hickel. Thank you for calling to testify. And we'll go now to Matt Rombach in Anchorage.
Hi, my name's Matt Rombach. I'm an Alaska resident for 18 years. I live in Anchorage, and I'm an Alaska Airlines pilot. Just want to add my support for HR 295. For those of us whose work takes us outside the state frequently, but in our case often briefly, so it's multiple trips every month, which adds up to dozens and dozens of trips every year. So I'll be brief. I just wanted to add my support, and I'll pass it on to the next person.
Thank you so much for calling, Mr. Rombach, and for your work as a pilot as well, everybody who's called so far. Next, we're going to go to Mark Lalonde II, who is calling us from Japan.
Hi, my name is Mark Lalonde. I'm an international cargo pilot with Atlas Air. I'm currently in Japan, but my residence is Anchorage. I've been in Anchorage for 15 years. My house is registered there. My vehicles are registered there. My wife lives there full time, and I have two kids that go to school there as well. And like everybody else has been saying, with the PFD, it's been a nightmare. We have to go through our schedule for 365 days and count how long we're in and out of the state. And as far as international pilots go, how long we're in and out of the country. It can be a challenge. And again, we're on the road 17, 18 days a month with no real say in where we go or how long we're in a place. But at the end of the day, it's just hotels that we live in. But our residence remains Anchorage. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lalonde, and for calling from such a great distance away. Similarly, next is Bradley Pearson, who is also calling us today from Japan.
Good afternoon. This is Bradley Pearson. I live just outside of Anchor Point, so I'm one of Ms. Vance's constituents. And as well as some of the one of the other callers, I also work for Atlas Air. Our schedules are not dictated by us. We're on the hook for 17 days a month. And for those of us who have chosen a life in the airline industry, it seems to be a double standard that's being applied, where if you live and work in the state of Alaska, you are held to greater benefits than people who live in the state of Alaska but have to work outside. And so one thing I would like to submit is a change of verbiage in House Bill 295. I am very much in favor of House Bill 295, but I would like to have that changed to flight crew instead of solely pilots, because there's more than just pilots and flight attendants that are affected by this. We have loadmasters, we have lots of personnel that have to travel, and including mechanics. And this affects a lot of people. In addition, I'm going to echo what a lot of the other gentlemen said prior, is the PFD. Every single year, I've been a resident of Alaska for 11 or 12 years now. And every single year, I have to fight with the PFD department and appeal. Every single year, my request is canceled, is denied, because I have to delineate down to every couple days. If I'm going in and out of the state of Alaska, they see that and they say automatically deny my petition for the appeal, and now I have to not the appeal, the PFD, and now I have to appeal it every single year. This is the case, and I find it just ridiculous that we have an exemption for people on the Olympic team, which you could probably count on two hands on how many people in the state of Alaska that qualifies for. Meanwhile, we have thousands and thousands of pilots, mechanics, flight attendants, loadmasters, and that live and spend all of their time off work,
Mr.
in the
Pearson,
state of Alaska. Meanwhile,
if you could, please wrap up your testimony.
Sure. So what it boils down to is, I believe that this our ability to get the PFD and therefore hunting and fishing privileges in the state of Alaska should be tied to how much time we spend away from the state on our time, not on company time. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for calling from, again, so far away today. We'll go next to Robert Herring in Anchorage.
Hello, my name is Robert Herring. I live in Anchorage. I am a pilot for UPS, lifelong Alaskan, born and raised here out in the villages. So hunting, fishing, subsistence, everything, that's a huge way of life for all of us out there. So if, you know, losing those, access to those with the hunting and fishing things coming up, that would make a big difference, and the PFD as well. So as all the other guys have said, you know, we're gone half year or more, and we don't have any control over that. So I'd like to see this amendment. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Herring, for testifying. And we'll go now to Burke Anderson, also in Anchorage.
Hi, my name is Burke Anderson. I'm a lifelong Alaskan. I currently work for Alaska Airlines. I've been flying for my paycheck now for 13 years, and I'm calling today as a representative of ALPA, the Airline Pilots Association. We represent roughly 700 pilots that are residents here at the state of Alaska, and our union strongly supports House Resolution 295. From our perspective, we're seeing that the current regulations penalize us for the nature of our work. You know, simply put, our office moves, and we aren't doing this type of travel electively. As some of the other callers have noted, pilots have very little control over our schedules and how often we are in or outside of the state of Alaska. And given that, the majority of our membership that is Alaska residents, the vast majority of them live in the state of Alaska. Their home is in the state of Alaska. Their only vehicle is in the state of Alaska. This is their home. And this legislation we see sort of clears up the gray area that we've been operating in as far as how absences are calculated. Given the fact that this isn't elective travel, this is inherent to the nature of our job. We see that these days when we're at work should not count against us towards this 180-day absence. And House Resolution 295 comes pretty close to addressing that. We want to address the language as well that some of the other callers brought up. We see that flight crew is probably some better terminology, given that there's potentially close to 1,000 of our other industry colleagues and other work groups that also face these same issues that have this burden of proof on them. But sort of just in summary, our union, the Airline Pilots Association, strongly supports House Resolution 295 and asks that it be moved forward.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Anderson. And we'll go now to Kyle Zimmerman in Palmer.
Hello. Thank you to all the committee members and the chair for allowing public testimony on this. My name is Kyle Zimmerman, along with Burke Anderson. I'm also an Alaska Airlines pilot with the Airline Pilots Association. I'm also what's called a district advocate. So what we do is we represent all of the pilots in the Alaska Airlines to legislative bodies such as yourself. And so I just point that out because I just wanted to if you guys have any questions about this, either on the record, off the record, feel free to reach out to one of us because we're more than happy to help with that. I don't want to keep echoing what everybody keeps already saying about how difficult it is for the PFD, which it is, and also how it has almost discouraged a lot of us from applying for the PFD. When it comes down to it, 295, it will help with the PFD, but it's more about the money. When I watched the initial reading of this in committee, I kept seeing the money side get brought up, and it's really not about that. What it's about is telling lifelong Alaskans who are residents here, who, like others have said, we have our house here, we have our vehicles here. My wife and I, when we moved up here, we immediately jumped in. We created a homestead. We fill our freezers with fish and with wild game, and we both started a business up here providing veterinary care to rural communities. And so we've jumped into the Alaska lifestyle. But what this bill, what the bill as a House Bill 93, what it will initially do is tell us that we're not welcome here. We're not residents. We're not, even though we have everything here, we no longer have a home because now you're telling us that we can't hunt and fish here. We can't, you know, support our lifestyles that lifelong Alaskans for generations have had. And that's really what it comes down to is allowing our pilots to keep that lifestyle that they've had. And like Burke said, ALPA represents 700 pilots in Alaska. That's not just with Alaska Airlines, it's also with FedEx. That doesn't include Horizon pilots and Atlas pilots and all of the other pilots that are going to be coming out of the state and the country. So there's I would guess over 1,000 pilots that this will directly affect. And then you add in the flight attendants and the crew members. And yeah, we as a union do support our brothers and sisters at the AFA, the for flight attendants,
Mr. Zimmerman,
to support this.
If you could just wrap up your testimony.
Yeah, absolutely. This is the last little bit. Was just that we support changing the verbiage to crew members to support flight attendants and other crew members to allow them to support their lifestyles as well. Again, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Zimmerman, and thanks for your testimony. We'll go now to Blake Galvin in Anchorage.
Hi, my name is Blake Galvin. I live in Anchorage. I'm a pilot with Alaska Airlines, and I just want to extend my support for HB 295. I work for an airline, Alaska Airlines, that is vital to this state. We bring in tourism, we bring in goods, we bring in slopers to the North Slope, and sometimes we're gone away from home, and it's unfair that those absences may be detrimental in hopes of getting a PFD. I have a family here. I have two kids. They go to school in Anchorage. I own a home. So I fully support adding, I hope, flight crew that includes pilots and flight attendants for this exemption to similar to what the Merchant Marines have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Galvin. And we'll go now to Rebecca Owens in Anchorage.
Good afternoon. My name is Rebecca Owens. I live in Anchorage. I'm coming today as a representative of the Association of Flight Attendants. Our union represents approximately 600 plus flight attendants between two different airlines here, along with the pilots that you've heard from today. We're about equally as long while still maintaining our residency keys here. The resolution is wonderful, adding pilots to this, for both the PFD as well as the hunting and fishing license. But once you introduce pilots, that'll make it that much more difficult for other crew members, such as flight attendants, to have these, you know, same benefits that we've, you know, we already find a little bit difficult to maintain them. But so we ask, while we are in support of the bill, we do ask that the resolution change the title to flight crew instead of pilots. That's all we got. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Owens, and thank you for your work as well and our flight attendants in Alaska. We'll go now to Chris Tansey, also in Anchorage. Welcome.
Hello, thank you for the opportunity to testify. I'm calling in support of House Bill 295 for all the reasons that everybody has stated already, so I won't go through it again. I would just offer a recommendation for tightening up the language as well to include everybody mentioned, but also just to make sure that, you know, every different kind of company. So I'm a FedEx pilot, so the cargo airlines as well as the people carriers would both be included in the language. And I would also offer the observation that perhaps making it easier for pilots to get the benefits of hunting and fishing licenses in the PFDs might also incentivize more people to move to Alaska, bring in an economic benefit as well. Again, thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Tanzi, for calling and testifying. I have heard a couple testifiers say this, and so I just wanted to clarify that this bill, that currently we're not saying that folks who are in these professions can't hunt or fish. They just would have to do so on a non-resident rate, which is a little bit different. And I respect where the testifiers are coming from, that we want to capture the resident rate, but just want to clarify that previous legislation that's been worked on in the building and this legislation don't prevent hunting and fishing licenses. They just provide an exemption for non-resident rate versus resident rate. And I again, just appreciate the testifiers thus far. We have a few more testifiers. We'll go now to Kristen Sprague in Anchorage.
Hi, my name is Kristen Sprague, and my husband and I are both pilots for Alaska Airlines. My husband and his family have been in Alaska for generations, and I've been lucky enough to call it home for about 16 years. Hunting and fishing is a huge part of our lives, and I'm calling to support HB 295. The nature of our jobs takes us out of state, and we shouldn't be punished for that. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sprague, for calling. Sorry, I got your name wrong there. And we'll go now to James Owens in Anchorage.
Good afternoon. My name is James Owens. I'm a commercial airline pilot for Southwest Airlines. I've been the Alaska resident for 6 years. I'm in support of Resolution 295 in that it would exempt at current in the language pilots to the hunting and fishing and PFD restrictions regarding the 180-day residency requirement. I would ask that the language be changed to include all flight crew, as in flight attendants and other support personnel, because like pilots in the language, it is it's equally difficult for other flight crew to process through the PFD, and the potential threat to the resident hunting and fishing license is also a disincentive to living in Alaska. This is our home. This is where we have our cars, my family. You know, everything is here. We shouldn't be penalized for the job that we and service that we provide. So with that in mind, again, support the HR 295 or House Bill 295, but we want the language changed to include flight crew. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Owens. Appreciate your testimony. And we will go now to Dave Cully in Anchorage.
Yeah, my name is Dean Cully. I am a pilot for Northern Air Cargo for the past 11 years, with another 5 years with ambulance service in Anchorage, and throughout the entirety of the 90s out in the Western Alaska as a pilot. I'm lucky that I don't really have this problem of being out of state a lot for my job. So as an advocate for my colleagues, without reiterating all the points that have already been made, my main problem with that wording in the bill is that it is too specific. It is directed at pilots, whereas it's flight operations personnel, which would include maintenance persons, load masters, and such. Most of my operations are within the state with Northern Air Cargo. However, we do contract work in the lower 48. And when that happens, we have maintenance people and loadmasters who spend a lot of time in the lower 48, and they live right up here in Anchorage, in the Anchorage area. And so I wish to just make clear that this needs to include everyone, flight attendants, anyone who travels as part of their Anchorage or their Alaska-based job. I think that covers it.
Thank you, Mr. Cully, for testifying. Appreciate you calling today. Do we have anybody else in the room or online wishing to testify on House Bill 295? Seeing none, either online or in person, we are going to close public testimony on House Bill 295. And again, just want to thank all of our testifiers today. I would ask if there is additional committee discussion on House Bill 295 at this time. Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you. To the chair, perhaps to the maker of the bill, you know, we've been hearing a variety of valuable testimony about adding on other job classes within the flight area, but in my mind, this still opens up the question of, are there other valuable trades, jobs, professions in Alaska that are impacted by the same situation? And it's really compelling to me to see this connection between what's happening with the PFD eligibility tying to hunting and fishing that really has a very personal impact on people's access to the beneficial opportunity that residents have in this area. And I'm thinking of oil and gas workers, other, in my world, sales and marketing that caused me to be gone from the state quite a bit. I'm just wondering if you've gained any additional thoughts or perspective on how do we look at this bill within the context of leaving this tied to just a pilot versus if we expand it out to flight operations personnel, which included, looks like, flight crews, loadmasters, maintenance personnel. Now we're down a slippery slope that I can, you know, appreciate that you understand. What's your perspective now on how we should look at this in terms of, will we deal with this challenge that is being created with the PFD in this bill, or do we move this ahead and then we wait for the next oil and gas bill for those workers and for sales workers down the road? I'm curious your thoughts at this point from what you've heard and how you might view what we do with this. Thank you.
Representative McCabe. Representative Kevin McCabe here, through the chair, Representative Holland. I focused on pilots because Anchorage is a crossroads for pilots. It's a crew base for many pilots. It's where we, where airlines fly into for a fuel stop and a crew swap. So many, many, many pilots, as you heard, live in Anchorage, as well as the Alaska pilots. So I kind of focus on pilots as the big subset that was affected. I recognize that there could be other groups. I'm not sure if this is the crossroads for the sales force of the United States, but, you know, certainly there could be some salesmen. I do know that there are a number of workers on the North Slope that live in the lower 48, but typically their residence is in the lower 48 and they come up here to work. They're not Alaska residents that go outside after they spend their 2 weeks in Alaska. So I'm not sure that that subset is very big. I didn't really consider that, truthfully. Couple other things that we discussed. We had a question about definition of a United States airline. There was a question about foreign airlines. I do have a written definition that comes directly out of the Federal Aviation Regulations and the U.S. DOT regulations that I'm happy to either include or insert as an amendment. And I'm fine with a flight crew amendment. Sorry for all those listening online. I'm a freight dog. We don't have flight attendants much. I mean, we did have some, but not necessarily based in Anchorage. So I just focused on the freight crew or the freight airlines for the most part. So, you know, I'm happy to include any amendments that will mitigate this. And for me, the issue really is it not found here. It's found in the other bill in HB 93. And a good chunk of that is because we are going to, there's a number of dip net fisheries, that if you're a non-resident, you do not qualify for. There is no non-resident DIPNET license, and there is no non-resident subsistence fisheries. You have to be a resident of the state of Alaska. So if we are excluded as residents for this, we actually cannot fish some fisheries. Even if you got a non-resident fishing license, you cannot fish a dipnet fishery or a subsistence fishery. So I felt like this was important enough, and every, you know, Representative Himshute co-sponsored it, and she thought it was important enough to offer as its own bill so we could have this discussion, frankly. And I mean, it would have been much easier just to put it in as an amendment, but we wouldn't have been able to have this discussion and talk about crews and talk about other cohorts of employees somewhere. So one of the really frustrating things to me, and you heard, I think, one testifier say it, but merchant mariners have been excluded almost from the beginning of the permanent fund dividend. And they're not the only ones that are gone for long periods of time that still want to be Alaska residents. So,
follow up.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for that. I just note, in terms of oil and gas workers, I worked with a lot of the business operations and engineering personnel that are staying in Alaska, and they're headed down to Houston, Bartlesville, for quite a bit of time for projects down there, and they want to stay in Alaska because that's where their home is. So just a clarification on that particular area. You know, it was really compelling to me. There was a comment by one of the persons testifying about, you know, should we not look more carefully at how much time somebody spends in state and their personal time versus their company time. That comment, I think, really struck home the question of where is your home, where are you staying? And if you're on company time, then that's separate. So I guess I just want to wrap up for the moment. And, you know, I am curious if we have or we could learn anything from the Permanent Fund Division, if they have any data on the challenged applications that they can associate with people that are in jobs that take them out, and that they have somehow maybe tagged or flagged as this is a profession that we see over and over and over again struggling to document their time. But through that, we now see some of these areas, and I expect pilots and other flight crew members might show up if they're collecting job classification information. And perhaps Department of Labor has some information that might help us quantify this issue. So I don't know if that's an opportunity if you want to pursue that, but it would be interesting to see if there's a little more clarification on other areas that are being impacted by this. But thank you for the time to kick those questions around.
Thank you, Representative Holland. I think I had said at the last hearing we would try to get someone from Department of Labor to come talk to us about other professions, and I do not believe that we actually followed up on that. So I'm going to commit that we will follow up on that when we're hearing this bill next. One thing I would also note is I really respect the discussion around who should this language apply to and how many professions should we include. I recognize that lots of people will fall at different places on that discussion, but for me at least, I see this bill as streamlined and solving an immediate challenge for a specific profession, as other legislation in this building has sought to do. And I would be potentially strongly in favor of other legislation that did that for other professions. But taking these up sort of in a vacuum, these different professions and potential exemptions, is in my opinion, the way to approach this, just so we can critically look at each of these different items, as opposed to trying to come up with that broad brush list all at once. And so I appreciate where that is going. I do respectfully want to see this legislation move forward, as well as other legislation that's addressing issues that have been sort of vetted. And hopefully that adds a little bit to this discussion too. Representative Himshute.
Thank you. I actually did have a couple questions for the division, for the Permanent Fund Division.
Sure thing, Ms. Wojtusik. Come on forward. I will say we're also going to probably wrap up discussion on this bill about 4:30, so we have time for our last bill hearing today.
4:30. Okay. Thank you. Through the chair, thank you for being here and helping us with this.
Of course.
I wanted to know, on the fiscal note, you're looking at $113,000. So is that, are you looking at sort of an average dividend amount, or is this just the staffing? I see personal services there. So can you help me understand the fiscal note?
For the record, Genevieve Watusik, Division Director for the PFD Division. Thank you for the question. And I believe there's an updated fiscal note that should be in your folders for this bill that was submitted.
Do not have
there is
that.
A apologies. There is a forthcoming fiscal note that is an indeterminate note. The personal services line was removed, as our original determination of the bill had over 4,000 pilots that were Alaska commercial ATP. Is that, okay, thank you, Representative. Registered, and that was through a document through the sponsor's office. But then, after continued discussion with the sponsor's office, he noted that it would be closer to just a few hundred pilots that he believed would be affected by this legislation. So we were able to remove that PCN that we originally had. And so that line is now zero for personal services. It is still an indeterminate fiscal note for the programming of this change. It's a new allowable absence. There is logic involved in that programming, and it will be included in our new system if this legislation passes.
Follow up. It sounded like a few of the folks who called in today still apply. So you already have staff having to do those determinations to deny them or whatever. So it makes sense to me that you wouldn't necessarily need more staff. It might actually take fewer staff because it's more straightforward if this bill passes. So just a thought. What counts as a day if a pilot is in Alaska until 8 in the morning and then flies to Seattle? Are they in Alaska for the calculation of the however many days?
Through the chair, Representative Himshue, that's a great question. And there is some gray, but for the most part, if they started in Alaska, they count in Alaska that day. But if they're not back that day, then that next day, they would be an absence day.
So March 17th at 8 in the morning, I fly to Seattle to begin a two-week shift of flying around in the lower 48. Because I'm not back on March 18th, I can count the 17th as a day in state, but not March. My time out of state starts March 18th.
Through the chair, Representative, that's correct.
Okay, through the chair, follow up. If I left on March 18th at 1 in the morning and I flew to Seattle and was out of state for a few hours and then I came back, is that would fall under that, having been there for at least a partial day counts as being in Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative, I believe so. In speaking with the sponsor, we haven't seen the reports of how the pilot logs are. I believe he mentioned there were Ames reports. So we need to see how to view it. But if they left and came back on the same day, mm-hmm. we believe that would be an in-state day.
Okay. Just a quick comment.
Sure. Representative Himshue.
Thank you so much, through the chair. I guess I'm just really impressed with the work you do. It must be tedious at times, so thank you for that. And thank you for the attention
thank you
give to that and the context you're providing for the bill. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. And I just like to say we have a small but wonderfully mighty team. It's less than 70 people that determine over 100,000 Alaskans each year. Over 500,000 are automatically determined through our system, but over 100,000 are done by the work of our wonderful team.
Wow.
Thank you.
No, thank you.
That's incredible. I never knew that. Thank you for answering those questions. Do we have additional questions or discussion? Seeing none. Thank you to our testifiers today. If anyone's still online for testifying on House Bill 295, and to our bill sponsor, Department of Revenue folks, I am setting House Bill 295 aside today, and I'm setting an amendment deadline again also for tomorrow at 5 p.m., Wednesday, March 18th. Again, please, on any of these bills we have deadlines for tomorrow, please feel free to get in touch with our office if there's any challenge scheduling with, or any challenge working with Ledge Legal to get those completed. It's my intention, as time allows, to take this bill up on Thursday. So, and that will bring us to the final item on our agenda today, which is a first hearing on House Bill 214, Motor Vehicle Proof of Insurance, from Representative Galvin. Today we will have an introduction from the sponsor's office, entertain committee discussion as allows, and then set the bill aside for a future hearing. Welcome to Representative Galvin and your staff, Lacey Matula. if you'd like to go ahead and put yourselves on the record and proceed with the introduction.
You bet. Thank you very much, Co-Chair Carrick. I've been excited to present this bill, HB 214, today. And for the record, my name is Representative Elise Galvin, and joining me is my staff member, Lacey Matula. House Bill 214 relates to proof of insurance, commonly known as SR 22 certificate. And it's required after a judgment connected to a motor vehicle accident involving an uninsured driver. Under current law in Alaska, if someone is found responsible for damages after an accident and the claim is not resolved on time, a judgment is issued against them, resulting in suspension of their driver's license. To reinstate their license, the individual must satisfy the judgment and provide proof of insurance through an SR-22 certificate, which ensures accountability and verifies active coverage. The average cost can be, to Alaskans, can be thousands of dollars a year for that. And that money goes to the insurance companies simply for them to file that certificate to the DMV. So to be clear, individuals subject to this requirement may face ongoing monthly costs indefinitely if they wish to keep their driver's license. And Alaska is the only state that has no time limit on how long a driver must maintain an SR-22 certificate to demonstrate proof of insurance after a lapse of judgment. This bill maintains the requirement to demonstrate insurance coverage through an SR-22 certificate for one full year, while avoiding long-term, sometimes lifetime, financial burdens after a judgment is resolved. We have heard from many Alaskans who rely on their driver's licenses to get to work, and those who work as drivers, that this indefinite financial burden creates a real hardship and needs to be addressed. HB 214 offers a straightforward solution by establishing a clear time frame and requiring proof of financial responsibility for 1 year after the judgment has been satisfied or stayed. And I, when I say financial responsibility, I mean proof of insurance. This approach preserves accountability while providing a path forward once the individuals meet their obligations and demonstrate an understanding of the importance of maintaining insurance. In summary, HB 214 creates a fair balance, maintaining responsibility without imposing an indefinite requirement that can be overly punitive and harmful to individuals and the workforce that depends on reliable transportation. And thank you, and I'll be happy to answer questions after if you'd like, if it pleases the chair. We have a very brief, because this bill is so brief, but we do have a presentation by my staff as well.
Thank you, Representative Galvin. We can go ahead and go to the staff portion. Thank you.
For the record, my name is Lacey Matula, staff to Representative Elise Galvin. Thank you for the opportunity to briefly walk through House Bill 214 and the reason it has been brought forward. From Section 1, Line 5, it amends the Alaska statute by setting a clear time frame instead of an open-ended requirement. Individuals would need to maintain proof of financial responsibility for 1 year after the judgment has been satisfied or stayed. Thank you for hearing House Bill 214 today, and happy to answer any questions.
All right. Thank you. I have a question right out the gate. So tell me what the proof of insurance requirement is here versus just general proof of insurance requirements. Like if I get pulled over right now without any summary judgments behind me, I have to show my driver's license, my proof of insurance registration. What is this requirement relating to specifically?
So the difference is instead of you showing the this is Representative Galvin, and the difference between what you do, which is pull your insurance card out of your glove box, and you show it to the officer. In this case, in order to maintain a driver's license, to have one, the only way you may do that is to pay the insurance company monthly fees. Mm-hmm. And as I said, it can be thousands of dollars. I heard $1,700 from one person, over $2,000 from another. They pay the insurance company monthly fees in order for the insurance company to file to the DMV that they have insurance. And then the insurance costs also are up because the insurance company is able to increase insurance costs on top of that extra fee to report to the DMV that there is insurance. So it just turns out to be a burden, which we understand consequences are important. But in this one case, I don't think it was the intention of the lawmakers originally to not ever have a sunset clause, or at least a time frame wherein you would stop paying for this SR-22 certificate. That said, and again, I want to remind you that the committee, that there is no other state that has this never-ending requirement or burden on Alaskans or on drivers.
And just as a quick follow-up, so after the period of 1 year established in this bill, the driver would then default back to, pending other judgments or payments required, they would default back to the status quo for a regular driver on this issue.
Yes, there is still a state law that we must have insurance, and that would still be in place. The difference is because there has been an unmet or a judgment that was made late, and so at that time they had an extra penalty of proving that they will keep insurance forever, and that was because at the time of the judgment they didn't have insurance. So at the time of the accident they did not have insurance. So this puts an end time to that.
Great, thank you. We have a few questions in the queue. We'll go Representative St. Clair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the sponsor or staff, how many people does this impact? Do we have a number?
Thank you for the question. We have put that question into the DMV. My staff has, and she has. We have, and this was weeks ago, and we have not heard back yet. I'm not sure if the DMV is on the line. If they were, that would be great. We did tell them that this bill was being heard. But we did get, interestingly, we got a zero fiscal note. They understand that this is going on a lot. It doesn't really, for them, they just take it and incorporate it into their monthlies of who can and cannot have a license. I will say that I did hear from the labor union folks who have a lot of workers that it was from an apprenticeship program director, that this is an important bill to them. They think that a lot of workers have had a difficulty in paying their bills because of this extra couple thousand dollars a year that has impacted some of their workers. So I've heard that, but I haven't heard numbers, so I can't give you anything exact. Thank you for the ask, though.
Follow up? Why just accidents in this bill?
That is where, so for this bill, this is where it's impacting the SR-22. This is where that fits in, the certificate. And that's when that comes into play.
Follow up. DUIs, reckless driving, excessive speed, same things that you could lose your license for, you could lose your insurance for. I mean, this just specifically addresses accidents, but trust me, I've seen people lose their insurance over DUIs, have to get an SR-22, reckless driving, just there are a myriad of things. I'm just trying to – a myriad of different traffic offenses that could impact the insurance. So I'm wondering why this is just on accidents.
Thank you. I think my staff might be able to get to that.
Through the chair to Representative St. Clair, I think we just made it more of a broad aspect because with DUIs, there can be accidents with that as well, with reckless driving as well, hitting things. So I think it was just more in a broad term of all of that.
One last one.
Representative St. Clair, I'll tell you what. I will get back to you to figure out whether or not this change affects all. I believe it's related to a judgment associated with an accident, with an with a judgment that was made after a late closing of that judgment. So I will get back to you, though, to tell you specifically if it's related also to the DUIs and other things.
I promise. Last one. I promise. I swear. I promise.
Last follow-up, Representative St. Clair.
And I appreciate that. But a lot of it has to do with moving violations. And maybe the way to approach this is look at all SR-22s. Do they have or is there statute that says that, you know, after you get your second DUI, you have to carry an SR-22 and, you know, indefinitely? I think that what I'm trying to get at, what I'm trying to get at is the SR-22s are the issue at hand, and how long that they are put in place or required. I think it's for more than just accidents. I'm just trying, and I know you're going to get the information. I just want to put that on record. Thank you.
I appreciate that. Yeah, we'll make sure to get back to the whole committee as to what specifically and why we're addressing this line.
Great. I'll also just add, pursuant to that commentary, that our office will also invite the DMV to our next hearing on this bill, because I would really like to hear from them as well. Vice Chair Story, and then I'll have Representative McCabe after that.
Thank you, Chair Carrick. Thank you both for your presentation today and the bill before us. My question has to do with two questions. Why 1 year? Then you had said we're the only state who does not have a time limit on this particular requirement to have insurance. What other states do we have, sort of in other states, 2 years, 3 years? What time limits do they pick? I know when you're in an accident and the other person doesn't have insurance, you know, that's concerning. I know insurance is expensive to have insurance. I'm just curious. I don't know how long it takes to be in the habit of making sure that we get insurance, but I was just curious about other states and what they saw fit to require.
Thank you. And so other states that are anywhere between 1 year and 5 years, so they all have something, I'll tell you that. All the other states in the nation have a time frame when that ends. And I want to make sure I'm sharing the appropriate information, that this only applies to the lifetime proof of insurance requirement that follows an unsatisfied judgment. And so it's related to the unsatisfied judgments piece. There are other requirements associated with reinstituting a driver's license following other violations. And this bill only looks at the one that is following unsatisfied judgments, because it's at that point. There are already time limits on how long the SR-22 is required for DUIs. So that's already in place. The unending requirement applies only in the instance of an unsatisfied judgment. So I just want to make sure we're clear on that piece, that in the case of a DUI, there are actually, it's various rules depending on how many DUIs you've had. And I really don't take issue with that. We didn't want to get into the weeds of all of that. What we wanted to fix is the one place where it's never ending. And that really didn't make sense to us. So, yes.
Follow up. So I see in the bill that it's 1 year from the date the judgment is stayed or satisfied. So the person has satisfied the judgment, and that it's 1 year from that date that they would have to, that they would not have to pay the extra insurance.
Do you want to respond?
Through the chair to Representative Story. Yes, that would be correct.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you. We'll go now to Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Chair Carrick. I think the world's going to end because Representative Galvin and I have agreed on two bills in 1 week. One of them we have presented together. So, no, I think that SR-22 is a horrible program, expensive. I get when it's a DUI and we're trying to make a point, but I think maybe insurance companies have run amok, and it can, if you're a minor in possession in a car, it can affect your life for the next 20 years at $2,000 a month or close. And it's significant. And I don't think we need to make that kind of point. So anyways, I just wanted to say thank you.
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, I appreciate the bipartisan work that we've been doing. And I will add that it's one, it's in the thousands, it's usually per year. But still, that's certainly money off the table for groceries. And we know that's true for too many Alaskans. And I don't know how many, but I'm going to find out. Somehow this committee is going to get that number. So thank you.
And I'd also, if the bill sponsor's office could help us ascertain what the, if it's possible, the average cost of SR-22 insurance is, if you know.
Thank you. To the chair, the one number that we got to was $1,700. But again, these are private insurance companies that, and it's multiple, and they can charge whatever they want. You know, maybe that's another bill for us to think about down the road. But for now, what we do know is there's a range. And on top of that charge, the fee for the SR-22, insurance fees also go up by that insurance. So when they're trying to get their insurance to drive. So I just wanted to share that that's sort of a fuzzy number because it is asking private industry to give us their scale. I can give you ranges if that would be helpful, but we know of people directly telling us that one was $1,700 and another one was over $2,000 per year. So if that helps you, that's something that we do know.
That is helpful. I think if just on broad brushstrokes, if we had a range, that would be a good thing to
we could try to get that
ascertain. I do have a couple more questions in the queue. Representative Holland and then Hemshoot.
Great. Thank you. Through the chair, my first question has been mostly addressed with the discussion we've been having about the SR-2 and what it applies to. I would be interested in, as a follow-up, as you're looking at this issue, about how it is affected in terms of the length of time by the seriousness of the accident. If it's a major accident with a loss of life and other severe consequences, I'm wondering about the length of time this is in place versus if somebody has a fender bender on a slippery road and loses traction and bumps into the back of a car. That seriousness of the accident, if that is something that maybe shows up in other states as a factor of what determines how long it is, I could see it being a little variable that way. So just a thought on that as you look into the other issues. The other question I had that we haven't touched on yet is I'm curious whether or not there's any layer of this that affects whether or not this is somebody who is a commercial driver and in a commercial accident with a commercial vehicle or versus a personal vehicle traveling on their own. And does that layer into this issue about how SR-22s are handled and how long? We've generally held up professional commercial drivers to a different standard than we do for a resident or individual citizen. So I'm curious if that's a layer in this or not.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Holland, great questions. The first answer around the law and whether it distinguishes between the size of the outstanding judgment. And the answer is it does not distinguish. So the current law as it is, which is for your rest of your life, you will be showing and paying the insurance companies to prove that you have insurance. And then that every month gets reported into the DMV. Currently, there is not any layering. It is for the rest of your life, and it is what it is. And I don't believe that it is that they pay different price amounts according to the accident that I know of. It's just whatever the insurance company chooses to charge, as far as I know. But we will look into other states if that's what you prefer us to do. Happy to look at that. We looked at it somewhat, and I can say it's different everywhere. So Connecticut, it's 1 year, for example, and no matter what the judgment. And another one was Idaho. North Dakota is another one that's 1 year. Others have different years, but I didn't see as much layering depending on what the accident was. Remember, there's a judgment on top of that as well. So there's the, you will, you know, for DUIs, you will go to this sort of training, you will do this, you will do that, and that SR-22 certificate will be in place. So it's this is just one piece of what a judge would say, and I don't want to make sure we're clear on that. With regard to professional associations and certificates, I do not know that there's any differentiation for that as well, although the associations themselves likely have their own standards. So they have rules about how – I know my dad was a trucker, so he was vigilant about not speeding in Big Lake, I'll tell you that. They give a lot of tickets there in certain stretches, and he knew which ones, and it mattered, you know. So it does matter, you know. I think that your own professional association certainly keeps track, and you want to do right by that. But I don't know if we other states make laws particular to whatever their profession is. I think it might be within their organization. We just have laws that are for any driver. So every driver has to be safe and carry insurance and follow the laws. So I think it's a good question, but I'm not sure how much it will relate, but I will have my staff dig into that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. And I think final question for today, Representative Himshute.
Thank you, Chair Carrick. I just want to note for the record that when Rep. McCabe spoke, a little pig flew right past the window. I do have a couple questions, though.
That was for the record, though.
That was, yeah, I just wanted to make sure that folks knew that because not everybody can see. So, yeah. So, through the chair, my first question is, I'm assuming the worst from insurance companies, so I want to apologize in advance for that assumption. But if we set this year time limit, what's to stop them saying, well, we got to recoup some of those costs and without a cap, is it up to them how much they charge? So like now we aren't going to get this forever, so we're going to make it $1,000 a month. So I'm a little worried about that. Do you know, is there any kind of a cap on this? And this is the first time I've heard of an SR-22.
I have not heard that. Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Himshute, I didn't mean to cut you off. I apologize if you had more. Firstly, you never have to apologize to me about insurance companies. And with regard to caps, I have not heard of any state putting a requirement on insurance companies for that. But believe me, I'm happy to do that research as well. Great idea. And we'll have a look-see. I'm not sure.
And another quick question. Okay, thank you. Through the chair, my other question is just, what are the, again, this is my first encounter of an SR-22. Mm-hmm. So what are the insurance companies saying about this bill or about an SR-22? Where do they weigh in on this and say, well, here's why we do it? Or have you had conversations with insurance companies?
I have. Thank you, co-chair him, through the chair to Representative Himshute. I have not had any discussion with insurance companies. This is a bill, the state law says that the judge orders a potential, once again, driver, if you want to have your driver's license, you must prove up that you have insurance. So the state law tells insurance companies that they need their help to prove that up. So I'm not sure, I mean, for them, I'm not sure how much of a say they would have in this. I mean, certainly this is to their benefit. They would, they are able to profit from in their private business, which, you know, nobody's against a private business. And I have not sought their input. I'm sure what they would say is this is a great program, and it is important, I think, that we do have folks carrying insurance, because that flattens out big costs when there are accidents. So I imagine they would weigh in that they like it when people carry insurance, and they would probably like to help. There'd be some sort of punitive action so that people understand the importance of carrying insurance. And again, that led me to we didn't wipe out SR22s. What we said is, I think proving that you understand that insurance is important for a whole year is probably enough. And that's kind of where I left it. And other states have done that same thing. So I felt like anything, first of all, is better than an entire lifetime of, if you want to become a driver again, then this is what you have to pay. But I was thinking about how long. I'm sure we could have gone with 3 months. We could have gone with a year, 5 years, 10 years. But a year felt to me about right. And I'm open, if this is your bill now, so you may, you know, come up with all sorts of ideas, and we will help. We will do the research that you've asked us to do and bring it back to you so that you can make better decisions about, you know, how long and why and how much is this hurting the insurance companies. We'll do everything we can. We will even reach out to insurance companies and ask them how much this is hurting them or if they have opinions. You bet.
Okay. Well, I'll have to look into SR22s a little bit on my own to understand it better. It just seems like every Alaska driver is required to have insurance. So you're presenting this SR22 to DMV to get your license back or to the judge? Sorry, apologies, follow-up.
No, good follow-up, and Representative Galvin.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Hemshoot, the statute requires the DMV to require the SR22 in order for them to get their license back. So the judge the judge doesn't really have anything to do with it. What happens is the insurance companies are charging these fees because they need to take over that administrative burden that the DMV is asking for, which is proof of insurance. And it's a form. It's an administrative burden on the insurance company to fill out a form and get it to the DMV. And we will hear more from the DMV, I hope, soon. That says, yes, they've paid for their insurance and they have their insurance now in hand.
Final follow-up, I think.
Final follow-up.
I'm still just really baffled through the chair. Again, I'm encountering this for the first time, so I need to do some of my own homework. But why can't you walk in with your GEICO card that's current? Because I guess you could hold that card and have had that policy canceled, so this is an extra – okay.
This is through the chair, this is truly an extra piece of proving up that has been put into place all over the nation, because we want to make sure that if there's been a judgment that has been not complete, that there is something in place that is shaking Alaskans who want their driver's license to really make sure they have insurance. And that I don't know why it's called that. I think that's a good question. Why do they call it SR22? I'm not sure. And that's something I'll get back to you with too, Rebecca, because I can tell you're trying to understand, like, why the heck? Mm-hmm. Why not just show your GEICO card or whatever? And this is the way it is. I found out about it last summer. I was shocked too, that this is even an issue and that it's a lifetime. And this is this funny bill that has been in play for a while. That was something that was a surprise to me too. In fact, out of Sitka, the former representative from Sitka had this bill and was so frustrated because he got it all the way through the House, but then, you know, it was at the end of the session and little things happen. But I will share, it's an odd place. And as you can see, it's a two sentence bill. Yeah. And yet it carries a lot for a lot of people. And I want to make sure we try to get it across the finish line.
Thank you.
All right. We thank you, Representative Himshu and Representative Galvin. We are going to have to adjourn for today and set House Bill 214 aside for a future hearing. My intention is to bring it up. If not, when we are able to next week, for sure the following week. So I would ask members to continue to work on this, and thank you to the bill sponsor for bringing it up. With nothing else on our agenda, this concludes our business for today. Our next meeting is on Thursday, March 19th, here at room 120 at 315. Our agenda is as follows. We will take up House Bill 152 from Representative Galvin. She'll be back on Thursday. As a reminder, the amendment deadline, which was extended multiple times, is now firmly set for Wednesday at 5. We have already received about 7 amendments, and I know there are more coming. Please reach out to me immediately if you have trouble getting amendments to my office. After that, as time allows, we will take up in order House Bill 295 on PFD eligibility, amendments on that bill from Representative McCabe, and House Bill 189 amendments as they come forward for Representative Mears's bill on PFD convictions. If we have to roll either of those two bills, they will come up at our very next hearing. And we will do what we can to get through as much as we can on Thursday. With nothing else before the committee, we are adjourned at 4:51 p.m.